Thank you very much for coming this evening, ladies and gentlemen. Very brave of you to sacrifice a more celebratory Halloween for this lecture. I hope to show some slides later on that will maybe make my lecture a little less dreary. Throughout his long life, Plato turned many times to questions like, what is the beautiful? What is virtue? What is the good? By asking this, he often means, how do we grasp the essence of something rather than only enumerate different instances of it? For instance, in Meno, the dialogue that a lot of you freshmen have just read, Socrates asks Meno, what do you say virtue is? And Meno reels off a list of different virtues, some for men, some for women, some for children. Socrates teases him for offering him a whole swarm of virtues and in place of what he really wanted, which was what was the singleness of virtue itself. And he asks him, do you think there is one health of a man, another of a woman? Or is it the same form? Eidos is the Greek word, the same form everywhere. Or again, in the dialogue recounting Socrates' last day, the Phaedo, Socrates is talking about even numbers versus odd numbers. And he says, so the form, ideia is the Greek, of evenness will never enter into a set of these things, of three things. These two terms, eidos and ideia, resonate throughout Plato's dialogues, and they're often translated in the text, in the books that you have, as form or idea. But these English words only begin to suggest the full meanings of these original terms. Sometimes one finds both of these two words, eidos and ideia, translated indiscriminately as forms, and the lexicon even indicates that they can be synonyms. One wonders if there's a difference between them, and that's something I'd like to address tonight. These two terms are the crux of what is often called Plato's theory of forms or of ideas, as it's often referred to in the scholarly literature. It means something roughly like this. Every instance of some quality participates, to use the words that generally find in translations, participates in a form or Platonic idea of that quality that transcends the ordinary world of becoming that we inhabit. Well, what exactly are these forms, and how do particular instances participate in them? I'd like to try to look at these questions anew. And in fact, looking itself will be my central concern. To address these questions, I'd like to turn to the etymology of these words, which is pretty well known, but I think there are some interesting things that still remain to be found. And I hope that everybody's gotten a copy of this handout, which, has the handout been circulated at all? Is it possible for someone to pass out the handout while I'm speaking? I'd really appreciate that. But let me go over some of these words. This will be a kind of a palette, a collection of words of seeing from ancient Greek. They all come from a common Indo-European root, the root vid, which is seen in the Sanskrit root vid itself, which means to I know. And there's a Greek root that has a similar formation, it's vid, okay? And this can be found in somehow behind a lot of the words that we're thinking about. For instance, the verb that's the origin of these two words that we're talking about this evening, eidos and ideia, the verb that's behind it is the verb horao, I see, horao, I see, in the sense of perceive or be aware of. And it has an aorist form, idein, to have seen or grasped, a perfect, oida, I have seen, with the sense of I know. And this is the word which generates the two words that we're concerned with this evening, eidos and ideia. But let me, to place these words in some larger context, just offer you and remind you, those of you that are studying Greek now, of some of the other Greek words for seeing, because the exact quality and intention of these words is what's going to concern us this evening. For instance, think of the word blepo, I look, a more neutral kind of looking, but in the aorist, eblepsa is to cast a glance at something, just sort of. Apoblepo, I look steadfastly at something. I pay attention to something. I regard it. Emblepo, I look in the face, a word that will come back later on. There's also other words that I'd like to remind you of, skeptomai. I look about carefully, I spy out, as would a skopos, as a spy, a lookout. And hence it has the meaning, I view, I examine, I consider. And it's the origin of the word skepsis, viewing, perceiving by the senses, hesitating, doubting. The origin of the word skeptic, obviously. Another very beautiful Greek word is the verb theoreo. I look at, behold, contemplate, observe, and speculate. In the middle voice, a beautiful example of the Greek middle voice, theaomai, I behold with a sense of wonder. The middle voice indicating an intensification of the verb from my own perspective. And this is the origin of a lot of important and interesting words, as you'll see, theama, a spectacle. A theoros is an envoy sent to consult an oracle. A theatron, a theater, a place where one sees spectacles. Theorema, a theorem, an interesting stretch, something also that's beheld. And of course, theoria, a theory. So all of these, this gives us a sense of the verbs, some of the verbs that will be of a special importance. They all have to do with seeing, so it seems fundamental to try to begin to understanding what eidos and eidēia mean by thinking about what seeing is. To emphasize the visual quality, the word visual still comes from the same root vid, Jacob Klein suggested we would translate eidos as a look, or perhaps an invisible look. That is, the eidos is the look of something, its essential shape. And this goes back to Homer. For instance, there's a passage which speaks of Alcestis, loveliest of the daughters of Peleus, eidos aristos, she of the best eidos, the best looking one. In another place, Hector taunts Paris for his beauty and eidos. Eidos te come e te eidos. In this case, it means his handsome physique. This is already very helpful because our word form that eidos goes into has a kind of abstract sense. We say something is merely formal. And so because it has a Latin derivation, we lose the intensely physical sense that the Greek has that we saw in the Homer. For instance, in the beginning of Plato's dialogue, Charmides, eidos is used there to mean most of all the naked form of a beautiful person, nothing less, that's the object of a lover's inflamed gaze. So this gives a sense of the intensity, the physicality of that word, in its use in that dialogue by Plato. By contrast, I don't think, from what I can see, the word eidēia would be used interchangeably for that kind of a nakedness. Eidēia seems to be a little bit more mental, maybe less colorful, but it is not the same as our word idea. Ever since the 17th century, the philosophers of that time, the word ideas had a kind of private connotation. Ideas are the things inside my head, my ideas. On the other hand, Plato's term eidēia doesn't have this same private sense. By virtue of its origin as in the verbs of seeing, it has a kind of luminous openness, as in the eidēia of the even numbers that we had in the earlier example. Now, how is one to understand these verbs of seeing? My main point that I would like to bring forward this evening is generally, when we think about these matters, we approach them with a kind of common modern preconception, which is that seeing involves an eye that's something like a camera. It's a passive receptacle into which light rays penetrate and make some kind of an impression on the retina, right? That's the view that we begin with. But I think it's very, very important that really for the Greek thinkers who we're thinking of, especially for Plato, seeing was something completely different. Let me take you now to the second example that you find on the sheet here, which is, I think, the earliest attempt to describe what goes on inside the eye when we see. It's due to Empedocles of Agrigentum in Sicily in the early 5th century, which is cited for us by Aristotle. So this is passage number 2 on the handout. Here's Empedocles. As when someone preparing to set forth on a journey through a stormy night procures a lantern and lights it at the brightly blazing hearth fire, a lantern fitted with protection against the blowing winds, which its flashing beams scatter, being finer than they, so is it that the primal fire was originally entrapped within the membranes and delicate tissues of the round eyeball. These are pierced by ingenious passages in such a way as to prevent the abundant surrounding water of the eye from entering, while at the same time allowing the fire, by reason of its superior fineness, to pass through. A very interesting description. That is, there's a gentle fire of the same sort as the fire of the outer world that we see, but more gentle, that's somehow contained within the water of the eyeball. And vision, according to the beginning of this account of Empedocles, consists of some beams that are projected out of this inner fire. This is a completely different view, as you can see, than the one we usually have. Here, the eye emits beams that go out to the object. Empedocles' own view was more complicated. He also held that objects in the outside world did something. They put forth what he called emanations, aporoi, by which he meant films or particles, he didn't specify exactly, that would stream from the surface of objects, and then they could pass in turns through certain passages called poroi, such as the pupil of the eye. So his view is a complicated mixture of the beam, the fire going out, and the emanations coming in. It combines what we could call a projection theory of vision, the beams going out, with an absorption theory. Since we only have fragments of his writings, it's hard to know how he put it all together. But we do have accounts of it, and especially in Plato, especially in the third, well, it's numbered the second one, but it should be, the bottom of that page, an excerpt from the Meno. Socrates is there discussing shape, color, as examples in the course of their discussion about what is excellence. And this, Socrates brings the theory of Empedocles up as if it were the latest thing. Socrates, you and Gorgias believe in Empedocles' theory of effluences, do you not? Meno, wholeheartedly. And passages to which and through which the effluences make their way?
Yes.
Some of the effluences fit into some of the passages where the others are too coarse or too fine?
That's right.
Now, you recognize the term sight?
Yes.
From these, notice then, grasp what I would tell, as Pindar says. Color is an effluence from shapes commensurate with sight and perceptible by it. That seems to me an excellent answer. No doubt it's the sort you're used to, and you probably see that it provides a way to define sound and smell and many other things. So it does. Yes, it's a high-sounding answer, tragike is the Greek. So you like it better than the one on shape, the one that Socrates had been putting forth, that shape is the only thing that always accompanies color. I do. Nevertheless, son of Alexidamus, I am convinced that the other is better, and I believe you would agree with me if you had not, as you told me yesterday, to leave before the mysteries, but could stay and be initiated. Socrates doesn't seem to think very much of this high-sounding theory of effluences as if such a notion could only take in sophists like Gorgias or Meno. There may be a kind of ironic echo between the word aporoe, admission, and aporia, the kind of impasse that Socrates so often gets Meno boxed up in and that Meno becomes so furious about. Socrates' own preferred alternative, that shape always accompanies color, doesn't really address the question of vision. But we do have other accounts of Plato of theories of vision that are very, very helpful. His friend, his close friend, Archytas of Tarentum, who was a very important Pythagorean, had all apparently put forward a theory that was pure projection, just beams coming out from the eye, with the sole means of vision. But as Plato's student Aristotle pointed out, there's a big and obvious problem with all such theories. If the eye really sees only by sending out beams, it should be able to see in perfect darkness, which obviously is not the case. The other extreme, just to pause and set the contrast and show perhaps where the modern view comes from, the atomists took up the idea of the effluences that Empedocles had put forward, and they interpreted those films as being made out of atoms, and they called them eidola. It's a diminutive of eidos. It means little eidos, little images. It's an interesting word in Homer. Eidolon was a phantom or ghost, my only Halloween reference. Later on, it came to mean an idol, obviously. The atomists considered that the eye was radically passive, merely receiving the eidola, whose impact in the eye would register as sight. Aristotle himself took a much more complicated and interesting view. He became interested in the in-between medium, that is to say, the air that's between you and I. And instead of thinking of primarily beams coming out of my eye or effluences coming out of you reaching me, he thought that somehow sight was a state of activity of the in-between, that is to say, the transparent medium that lies between us. I think that this theory, which has not much been commented upon by modern scientists, has a very interesting anticipation of the theory of fields that came much later in Faraday and Maxwell, which also emphasized that light was somehow a state of activity of media. But still, although Aristotle has this new and very interesting idea, he places a lot of emphasis on the activity of the eye in seeing. And this is consistent with his general sense that all kinds of sensation take place on the model of digestion, really, as he discusses it on the soul. It's as if our soul is devouring or eating the world. Objects that are external to us somehow are able to form images within us. They are somehow transformed from their external selves into being part of our being. And there's a kind of metabolism that takes place by which the soul is able to eat the world as we're able to eat the food from it. It is very interesting, though, now setting aside these two other ancient alternatives, that for well over a millennium after Plato's time, the projection theory remained predominant. The absorption theory and eidola have a lot of problems. If you're looking at a big, huge mountain and it's emitting films of atoms that are big and huge, how do they pass through the pupil? How do you form an image? Why is it that more distant things appear smaller? There's no account given for any of these by the theory, the absorption theory of little images of eidola. It wasn't until about the 13th century that the great Muslim philosopher Ibn al-Haytham, called Al-Hazen in the West, rejected eidola finally in favor of a ray theory in which he thought that rays would enter the eyes. He didn't explain the physics of the rays, but he felt clear that he had persuaded himself that there couldn't be these eidola. Here he is going back to a geometric theory of vision about which I've really said nothing, which goes back to Euclid and Ptolemy, who set up a book very much like the geometry, the elements that we read in mathematics, except now it's the lines are rays. But interestingly enough, both for Euclid and Ptolemy, those lines are rays that emanate from the eye and go out, showing the depth of the presupposition. For the rest of the theory, the rest of the story of vision only really unfolded after the 17th century, when Descartes and Newton and others were able to put together a convincing theory that was able to address how the rays could enter the eye, how they could focus, how they could make images. Only after 1800 did the wave theory of light come through the works of Thomas Young, as you study in junior laboratory. And it was only after 1900 that we started to have the synthesis of wave and particle theory that we now are struggling with, as you study in senior laboratory. But I thought it would be interesting to mention these earlier phases of the discussion, because although we study the later phases of the theory of light, we never, for some reason, really think about what the ancients thought about it. And so it seemed to me very important. Now let me turn more completely to Plato's theory. It's not at all a primitive theory. And that's not just because it remained in place for a millennium and a half. Even now, we speak about eye contact. We talk about hard stares or glaring daggers. To gaze means to look outward, as if something streamed from our eyes. And I take these as profound indications, they're not just a manner of speaking, they're profound indications of the way our mind works, of a kind of phenomenology of vision, if you want to use a modern word. So that, as such, this projection theory may not be outmoded by being physically superseded by other accounts of light, because it may, in a very profound way, speak about our seeing, what the act of vision is for us. And if that's true, then the implications that Plato drew from that same theory of the activity of the eye may remain of permanent importance to us. Let me turn, for instance, to Plato's account of this in the Timaeus, because it shows, I suppose, or may show, if we believe that Timaeus is speaking for him, something of Plato's mature consideration of the whole question of vision. Timaeus is praised by Socrates for having reached the very peak of all philosophy. He's an Italian from a city nearby, Plato's Pythagorean friends. He tells a likely story of a craftsman god that shaped the cosmos, leaving it to lesser gods to make humanity. Now, after having leaved it to the lesser gods, now in excerpt number, it's labeled number 3 on the backside of this page, we hear, let me read you the whole of the account that Timaeus gives of vision. And he's speaking about the gods and how they're putting men together. And of the organs, they first build light-bearing eyes, having bound them in the face by the following cause. All the fire that wasn't able to burn but provides gentle light, they contrive to become a body kindred to each day, that is to say, the light of the day. For the unallied fire that is within us, which is brother to this, they made flow smooth and dense through the eyes, having compressed the whole eyes, but especially the central part, so as to fend off all other fire as was coarser, while letting filter through only such fire as was itself pure. So whenever the light of open day is all around the stream of vision, then, rushing out like to like and having become compounded with the fire of day, that stream composes with it one kindred body along the eye's direct line of sight. Wherever the stream that rushes forth from inside pushes against any one of the objects outsides that collide with it. Now, as for the entire stream of vision, once it has become similarly affected through its similarity to the outer fire of day, whatever it itself touches at any time, or whatever other thing it's touched by, it spreads the motions of these things throughout the entire body until they reach the soul, and thus produces that very sensation by which we say that we see. But when the fire that's akin goes off into night, then the stream of vision is cut off, for going out into the dissimilar, it is itself altered and utterly quenched, no longer becoming one in nature with the neighboring air, inasmuch as this air doesn't have any fire. So it stops seeing, and what's more, becomes an invitation to sleep, since the gods contrive the nature of the eyelids as a safeguard for vision. Whenever they're closed, they shut in the power of the inner fire. This power disperses and tempers the inner motions. And when these motions are tempered, peace comes about. And when this peace becomes great, then an all but dreamless sleep comes over us. But if some fairly great motions are left behind in the eye, then, depending on what sort they are and on what regions they've left, they produce phantasms of that sort and to that extent, which are copied inside and remembered as outside by those who have awakened. So Timaeus begins with the projection theory. The fire that's inside the eye is compressed and projected through the narrow opening of the pupil and bursts out smooth and dense, he says. Then that stream of inner fire interacts with the outer fire of the day, the external light, and the world that is the brother, he calls it, of the fire within it. When this happens, it's as if the entire stream of vision has become an almost palpable thread that can touch or be touched by that which it encounters. Then a certain motion, when it touches something, it can be transmitted back through the thread of vision, and he says, throughout the entire body until they reach the soul and produce the sensation of vision. Here, sight is a kind of touching, a direct contact between seer and seen, very different from our notion of passive reception. And it also becomes an interaction between the inner and the outer fire, in which the beam that's going out from the eye is the crucial first step, because without that beam going out, there's no indication in this account that the light, the outer light of day, could somehow penetrate into the eye and be registered as light. So that is, I think, a very important point. Now, you can see that this seems to speak to the problem of seeing in the dark that Aristotle raised, although Aristotle, when he writes about it, doesn't seem to recognize his teacher's solution, since he states it as if he hadn't solved it. If the outgoing beam of the eye encounters not its brother, fire, but its dissimilar, darkness, then it's quenched, and the inner fire retreats in the eyeball. The eyelid closes and gives rise to phantasms and flickering images. It's very beautiful description of what a dream is. And it's also an illustration that somehow the dream, the apparent reality of the dream world, a very complex thing, both demonstrates the process of seeing in itself when it's not allowed to go out into the world, but also describes what can happen when that meeting doesn't occur, that I'd like to speak about some more. Because dreams show the limitations of a purely inward-directed vision. Socrates remarks in the Republic that surely some terrible, savage, and lawless form, eidos, of desires is in every man, even in some of us who seem to be ever so measured. And surely this becomes plain in dreams. So this is a very interesting illustration of a dark side of the inner fire that we have in us. It becomes evident in the soul of the tyrannical man, in whom, as Socrates says, the opinions that were formerly released as dreams in sleep now run riot in daylight. So that, and this is Socrates again, what he had rarely been in dreams, he becomes continuously while awake. He will stick at no terrible murder or deed. The tyrant's world is a nightmare because his vision finally does not contact what really is. On the other hand, these same emanations from our eyes can reach out, can give us real vision. We cannot see or know without them. So let me turn now to Plato's Republic, which I know the freshmen are starting to read, to try to look at it with these considerations in mind and return to the forms. Let me talk a little bit about the story of the cave here, because it's obviously important. Just to tell the freshmen who haven't read it yet, it's a story in which he depicts the condition of human beings as being prisoners inside a cave. Light enters the cave. There's also a fire. The prisoners are bound facing the wall, the back wall of the cave. They see shadows. Men walk back and forth carrying statues and other things, and the shadows are registered and observed by the men of the cave, of whom that's all that they see. Socrates then imagines what if one of the men were compelled, dragged to go outside and see the light of the outer day, how his eyes would be pained, and gradually he would be able to look at the light of the sun, which then Socrates compares clearly to the eidos of the good. Now, there are a few interesting things about this. The light of the sun clearly is coming from outside the cave, but the light comes into the deepest recesses of the cave. It's not clear that what they see is only by firelight. The text isn't clear. At the beginning it says, the cave is open to light across the whole width of the cave, as if the sun were the source of the light. But then immediately afterwards, we read that their light is a fire burning far and above and behind them, casting the shadows that the cave dwellers wonder at. These are not contradictory lights, even though the text specifies that the shadows are cast by the fire. The simplest explanation is the nature of light is the same, whether it comes from fire or from the sun. If so, our cave fire emanates the same kind of light as the sun, only less bright. Then too, even the darkness-dimmed eyes of the cave dwellers are able to discern that light, although in a highly attenuated form. In the terms of Plato's image of the divided line is a continuous line without breaks that goes from the most clearly intelligible forms, eidos, down to the most shadowy and delusory images. Plato elsewhere uses the word eidola, that we've heard before, these little eidoses, for images that are seen in mirrors. But they too, by virtue of their name and by virtue of the continuous connection of all these forms of seeing, even of illusion, and what is true, there is something that holds them all together. Now, it seems very important, and the last excerpt that I have on the piece of paper that you have is the passage where Socrates is talking about how the leading outside the cave occurs. And Socrates emphasizes that it does not occur as though they were putting sight into blind eyes. Those are his words. He goes on to say what you'll see there in number 4. Socrates is speaking. But the present argument, on the other hand, I said, indicates that this power is in the soul of each, and that the instrument with which each learns, just as an eye is not able to turn toward the light from the dark without the whole body, must be turned around from that which is coming into being, along with the whole soul, until it is able to endure looking at this which is, and the brightest part of that which is. And we affirm that this is the good, don't we? The power that is in the soul of each is the power of vision, the power to see the light, whether it is dim or bright. Though the source is clearly the sun, the good outside man, the crux for Socrates in this passage is that the power that is in the soul of each, that beam that they can send out to meet that light, is crucial. For instance, when Socrates later on is speaking about the final stage of the education of the philosophers, he says, "We shall require them to turn upward the vision of their souls and fix their gaze, apoblepsi, on that which sheds light on all, namely the good itself." Here Plato explicitly describes the souls of the philosophers as emitting a brilliant beam of light that meets the light of the good. But I would like to emphasize that this beam is not restricted to those with the souls of gold, as in the noble lie, for it is a lie, however socially useful. This power is in the soul of each. Perhaps Plato means the lie as a provocation to the nobility of his hearers, so that they might reflect that their ability to see and understand is not peculiarly theirs, nor restricted to them. So now, let me just reflect for a moment on this phrase, this power is in the soul of each. Plato's use of the word power, dunamis, does not indicate a faculty, something that's pre-given and set. It's something that can be flexed or exercised or allowed to degenerate. And he also tells us that this power has to be turned. His image, he's very clear about talking about how the eye of the prisoner somehow has to turn with the whole body and with the head. It has to turn towards that which is brightest, symbolizing the entirety of the soul turning. That is, the crucial exercise of our power is that we have the power to turn our gaze in one direction and another. And that gaze, maybe that's the one thing we have that can't be guided by any kind of compulsion. Socrates is very sensitive throughout the book about the danger of any kind of teaching through compulsion. He says, instruction must not be given the aspect of a compulsion to learn. He, having said that, is very curious that in the story of the cave we hear about how the man is dragged and the people are compelled. Very curious, because we realize, in fact, that can't occur. Maybe the paradox of his choice is artistic, and he's chosen this artistically. The language of compulsion provokes our souls to consider freely what it would mean for us to turn our gaze to the light, in the mirror somehow of thinking about what it would be like to be compelled. I think, in a way, Socrates, Plato here, is acting as a painter, knowing that we can always shut our eyes or turn our gaze in some other direction. But art can be used to draw our gaze, knowing that without, however strong the effect of the artists, they'll be nothing if we don't gaze at them. It's clear that Plato has to do this because he wants us to be lovers of the sight of truth, as he says, philotheomenos. If he wants us to be lovers, we have to do so willingly. He also uses what he explicitly says is a prime artistic principle of painters, that artists in general, that the best means that they could use are those, as he says, that at the same time go over to the opposite sensation. That is to say, he's critical of visual arts that don't do this, that seem to make sensation perfectly adequate and unproblematic. Maybe he's thinking of the famous Greek paintings that were so realistic, the painting of grapes by Apelles, that the birds would come and peck at it because they thought it was the real thing. Socrates somehow is not happy with that, and he wants in his own painting of the cave to summon our intellect by feigning to compel what cannot be compelled. There are other interesting and contradictory elements that I put forward for you as questions. If the good is really like the sun, what are we to make of the very well-known fact that it is dangerous, maybe even impossible, to look directly at the sun? Is Plato telling us that human knowledge fails as it approaches these supreme forms, or does he implicitly realize that his metaphor doesn't hold here? Yet he doesn't say anything of the kind. He tells us, though, that the man's eyes, who's being dragged out, would hurt at first. The man who leaves the cave would Make out the sun, he says, not its appearance in water or some alien place, but the sun by itself in its own region, and see what it's like. Perhaps this contradiction is meant to summon our intellect to reflect that, unlike the sun, the vision of the good is finally consonant with our human gaze, and perhaps a completion of that gaze as the fire within meets and returns to the fire without. Perhaps with this in mind, then, we can also think about the mysterious phrase that Plato uses of how the individual good things participate in the eidos of the good. Plato's characteristic verb here is metechein, meaning to participate, to share in, to be in on something, like a secret. The verb is literally metaechein, meta having, not just to have alone or in isolation, but to have in common, to have in between, in cooperation. Here, this projection theory of vision makes a lot of sense, because it is a cooperation that's streaming between, light that's streaming between our eyes and the light outside, that it's his brother. That is to say, the individual instances of good likewise operate with the good that lies between, but beyond us, in just the way that our vision reaches out from us, is sustained by what is beyond us, touches its object, and returns to us to touch us in turn. There's a deep reciprocity here between the act of touching, seeing, and of being touched in return, knowing, so deeply interconnected that it is hard to separate them. One can separate these two in thought. Let me try to do that for a moment. Consider the larger question of the Republic. Why should we choose to be just if we could get away with being unjust, scot-free? As Glaucon imagined this possibility, he imagined severing the link between our actions and their reciprocal response, the response that comes back to us. Imagine never having to suffer any consequences, as if our acts didn't come back to us, just as our vision returns to us. Socrates responds by building up the many ways in which our unjust acts rebound back on us, and which lead to the many ways, by comparison, the many ways, the 729 ways, in fact, by which the good man is that much happier than the evil one. These are all examples, I think, of the primal pattern of vision as reciprocity. As you touch, so shall you be touched. To test this further, I would like to examine a few examples now that go beyond Plato, but would like to open up this question of seeing, because it seems to me still very mysterious. It's not clear that we know how to see at all, or that we've even begun to see. When we think we see, often we're just putting in images that are from our memory. There's not a great deal of intensity or deeply felt awareness of what we're seeing. Consider, for example, a brief section of dialogue from Henry James' novel, The Ambassadors. It doesn't matter the situation, but you'll see what I mean. "They've got you," she portentously announced. "Do you mean he is?" "They've got you," she merely repeated. Though she disclaimed the prophetic vision, she was, at this instant, the nearest approach she had ever met to the priestess of the oracle. The light was in her eyes. "You must face it now." He faced it on the spot. They had arranged every move of the game, and they've been arranging it ever since. He had had every day his little telegram. It made Strether open his eyes. "Do you know that?" "I do better. I see it." The intense dialogue between knowing and seeing here raises the mysterious question of the process of vision. What does that light in her eyes mean? What has she seen? What do they know? Let me take a few examples now from visual arts, which I think might be helpful, because it seems to me hard to believe that in our search or struggle to find out what it means to see, that we couldn't earn a great deal from works of art, and certainly I have. And over the years, I've wanted to thank Robert Bart and Michel Binder, Steve Hauser, Phil LeCure, whose slides I've stolen, and I will show you now. Let me see here, let me turn off the slide. Okay, I hope this is going to work. I'll try to stand out of the way, sorry. I would like to begin with a few slides that bring forward the shaping power of the eye. This is a drawing of a horse's head by Veronese. And here, what interests me is the way in which the pencil of the artist touches the canvas. There's our eye also reaches out, these beams from our eye somehow reach out and touch the canvas also. Now I'd like to take a very different example, also obviously a horse head. How do we know that? But it's a horse head was drawn by a painter who lived 17,000 years ago and painted on the walls of the Lascaux Caves. This representation of a horse head. Again, there's a way in which our eye re-experiences with great detail a very complex pattern of not necessarily representation, perhaps it's evocation. There's some complex dialogue going on between the brush, was it a brush, what did he or she paint with, and the wall of the cave, as for whatever unknown reason they evoke this head. And this is the Horsehead Nebula. Millions of light, probably 300,000 light years from us. There's no horse there, but we see it somehow. Certainly the eyes, the beams of our eye have not reached that far, but in seeing this image, it is somehow strange to contemplate how strongly the shaping power of our eye works on what is probably just a cloud of dust and gas. Let me turn now to a very different painter who lived at a very different time from the Lascaux painter, but actually not that far, only a few miles away, which is Paul Cézanne. And I wanted to look at a painting he made in the period 1902 to 1906 of the Mont Saint-Victoire, this mountain. Here's a photograph from about that time, early 20th century, how it looks just on the outskirts of Aix-en-Provence. Here it seems to me interesting to contemplate the touch of the artist in a way that maybe it reminds me more of the Lascaux artist than of anything else. Our eye, and I will take you around a series of details of this painting, our eye moves around this painting and observes the intensity, the way in which the color, the direction, the texture has been chosen throughout. Let me just take you some details. Notice also how Cézanne has apparently allowed the canvas itself to peek through, as if by the contradiction between the bare canvas and the strokes that he's imposed, raise for us the question of the contradiction between the bare canvas and those strokes, the touches. By coming closer also, we're able to do something which we're not able really to do when we look at these representations in general, which is what's lost in all these representations is the actual sensation of the touch of the artist. So we have to imagine that we're putting our nose really close to it. There's no bulletproof glass, no guard, and we're actually coming in touch. Our eyes are more and more directly contacting it. Let me read you a little passage, some conversations that Cézanne had with his friend Joaquin Gasquet. And he's talking about the Mont Saint-Victoire. Color is the place where our brain and the universe meet, says Cézanne. That's why color appears so entirely dramatic to true painters. Look at Saint-Victoire there, he's looking at this canvas. How it soars, how imperiously it thirsts for the sun, and how melancholy it is in the evening when all its weight sinks back. Those blocks were made of fire, and there's still fire in them. During the day, shadows seem to creep back with a shiver, as if afraid of them. High up, there is Plato's cave. When large clouds pass overhead, notice how the shadow following from them quivers on the rock, as if it were being burnt up instantly consumed by a fiery mouth. Gazing up at the mountain, he somehow saw Plato's cave, and that vision somehow transformed and informed the touches of his brush. My next example is very different. It's Peter Bruegel the Elder's painting of Hunters in the Snow, about 1560, as I recall. Here, the act of seeing takes on a different form as we look at this wintry scene that I will lead you through. Some hunters have reached the crest of the hill with their dogs behind them. Are they weary? Did they come back empty-handed? And there, and our gaze throughout this amazing painting is directed to all kinds of scenes of daily life that are depicted. And also to the landscape that's beyond. Notice the bird. In this series, and remember that this canvas is much smaller than the scene, is noticeably smaller than the scene you see in front of him. Now we're going into details of almost inhuman delicacy, things that I don't understand how he could have painted. Now we're looking at something that's about a square inch on the canvas. It's also a kind of holiday. It must be very cold, and people are being pulled about and having a little bit of fun. They're skating. There are all kinds of funny daily scenes that are happening here, someone carrying wood. But imagine the way in which our eye is being led or tempted to follow these scenes around, inconceivably small. There's this funny guy here. What is he doing? But Bruegel has seen him. And now, as a result, we can too, although he's quite mysterious. There's these beautiful mountains to the right, and our eye is taken up by them to these birds. And we suddenly realize that we've been looking down on this scene from above, even the hunter's point of view, although we're tempted to think that we're looking out at them with them. But we are somewhere perhaps closer to the bird. So that simultaneously, in a feat of vision that both completes and negates, extends anything that we've ever seen, we're seeing from more perspectives with more detail, maybe than any human eye could possibly see. Further in this same direction, I think, is the work of the supreme painter, Jan Vermeer. This is the woman holding the balance of 1664. Here, it seems to me we're taken from this wonderful outside scene in which the vision meant something about contacting the light of day, although it was the rather gray light of a day in the Netherlands. Now we're inside. The only light that penetrates is dim and obscure through the window. But what happens in this interior space is nothing short of miraculous. The way in which Vermeer sees and shows us these passages seems to me to go far beyond even very interesting questions of why is the woman weighing, what is she weighing, and for what purpose is she indeed pregnant? What do the two things have to do with it? And what about the scene of the Last Judgment that peers over her shoulder, which I will show you, but in a very, very darkened painting. Our attention is directed primarily, first of all, to her. And every inch of the canvas, I'll get closer, is an astonishing act of vision, the shadow of the light going through. Is it a hand? This is a very small canvas also, perhaps only a quarter, of less than a quarter of the size of what you see. There are the details of the Last Judgment, another kind of balancing or weighing, I suppose. You can even see the texture of the canvas. And most mysteriously, the light that comes through. Here, our seeing, actually, for a while, I wasn't even sure what it was, or wonder what, in fact, that is. Is it a mirror? Is it another painting? By the act by which we're seeing in this painting is a kind of an education that can't be duplicated in any words, but it seems to me has an unforgettable kind of effect. It's clear that Vermeer's touch is almost inhuman in its refinement, the gradations, the way in which his brush has touched the canvas is really impossible to see aside from staring very, very close at the painting itself, and even then, it's a mystery. Let me choose as my final example two self-portraits of Rembrandt that take us to a different extreme. When the artist was 51 years old. Here, we're alone. There's no balancing, there's no weighing. There's only the artist in his studio looking at himself. There's a great deal to be said about his expression, about his eyes, about what it signifies and what he's lived through. But in a way, I don't want to talk about that right now, as strong as it is, as very powerful as it is. Instead, I want to talk about the quality of his gaze itself. Because if it is really true that vision is a beam that comes from the eye, here, as he contemplates the beam from his own eye, and we too contemplate it with the beams of our eyes, there's some way in which I think we're being instructed in a mystery of seeing at an amazing level. At this level, you can see the strokes of the brush and the way in which, sometimes tightly but often very freely, Rembrandt's brush has flowed over to give this astonishing sense, first of all, of life, but of a kind of philosophic depth to the painting, which is amazing. Now, consider this is 1657, 2 years later, 59, he's 53 years old. I know there are many passages in which Plato speaks critically of the visual arts as mere imitations, and I think I know what he means, but it seems to me if he could have seen paintings like this, he might have found them very interesting and deeply philosophical, as it seems to me they really are. If we're interested in what it is to see, which I think is a deeply part of what Plato is teaching us, I think we have a great deal to learn from these. It seems to me that, as I've suggested earlier, somewhat playfully, that besides being a great dramatist, which we all know, that Plato is also a painter, despite all the things he said about painting. And there are a couple of scenes I'd like to close with, which show to me something of Plato's art as a painter I'd like to put before you. Near the end of The Sophist, the young Theaetetus and the stranger weigh the possibilities that all things come forth spontaneously, without intelligence, or that they have a reasonable and divine end. Theaetetus then says, "I often go back and forth between the two opinions, perhaps because of my age. Yet now, as I look at you, Leipzig's essay, and gather that you think that they come to be in accordance with God, I myself also adopt this belief." Here, Theaetetus's gaze meets the stranger's, leading him to a new seeing. There is also a parallel moment at the end of the Republic, in Book 10. Socrates is speaking to Glaucon. "Haven't you perceived," I said, "that our soul is immortal and never destroyed?" And he looked at me in the face with wonder, "Emblepsas moi kai thaumasas," and said, "No, my Zeus, I haven't. Can you say that?" The way Glaucon looks at him is very beautiful. Partly it is that he's so surprised at the idea that the soul may be immortal. But even more, it is the way in which his own soul flashes forth at that moment, exactly by looking Socrates full in the face, as Plato so carefully paints. This may be the moment that his own immortality shines out, at least in our eyes. We remember that Glaucon is Plato's brother, and we remember, too, Timaeus' description of how the inner light meets its brother, the outer light. This is a very beautiful encounter of brothers. But we also remember Glaucon's own name, which means gleaming, glaucos, perhaps also a blue-gray color, the color of his eyes, perhaps. It calls closely related words like glaucion, to glaring fiercely or glaring blindly, having a glaucoma. All of these evoke a certain intense gleam, as from the sea, the kind of look that that Glaucon gave just then. Such a gaze is the essence of human communication. It goes beyond seeing a naked form, because catching sight of such a gaze is poised mysteriously between the visible and the invisible. The way we catch and interpret looks, the looks that people exchange, goes far beyond the very meager visual data that we have. How can you tell when a person has a little twinkle in their eye or a slight hesitation in their expression? Perhaps eidos in eidēa can only be captured by something as invisible but real as our own gaze. Plato sets Glaucon's gaze for us to gaze at in turn. Gaze meets gaze. That is eidēa. Thank you.